So we continue these studies in the life of Elisha. We're going to be looking at this afternoon 2 Kings chapter 8. 2 Kings chapter 8. And we'll be reading the first 15 verses of 2 Kings chapter 8. Two accounts, and we're going to be bringing them together under the themes of two different manifestations of the providence of God. Let's hear the word of God. Now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, "Arise and depart with your household and sojourn wherever you can. For the Lord has called for a famine and will come upon the land for 7 years." So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God. She went with her husband and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. At the end of the 7 years, when the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, she went to appeal to the king for her house and her land. Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, "Tell me all the great things that Elisha has done." And while he was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appeared to the king for her house and her land. And Gehazi said, "My lord, O king, here is the woman, and there is her son, whom Elisha restored to life." When the king asked the woman, she told him. So the king appointed an official for her, saying, "Restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields from the day that she left the land until now." Now Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. When it was told him, "The man of God has come here," the king said to Hazael, "Take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and require of the Lord through him, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?'" So Hazael went to meet him and took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camels loads. When he came and stood before him, he said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, sent me to you, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?'" And Elisha said to him, "Go say to him, 'You shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die.'" And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed. And the man of God wept. And Hazael said, "Why does my Lord weep?" He answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with the sword and dash in pieces the little ones and rip open their pregnant women." And Hazael said, "What is your servant who is but a dog that I should do this great thing?" Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Syria." Then he departed from Elisha and came to his master and said to him, who said to him, "What did Elisha say to you?" And he answered, "He told me that you would certainly recover." But the next day he took the bedcloth and dipped it in water and spread it over his face till he died. And Hazael became king in his place. On the surface, these two accounts seem rather different. But if we look at them from the perspective of the way God's providence works in this world, we see two interesting examples of the providence of God. Yet, they are examples of God's providence in polar opposite sort of ways. Both examples of God's providence, but very different kinds of examples. The first one is of unexpected blessing. The second one is about the Lord directing the sinful acts of human beings, even in the midst of political intrigue. Well, let's look at the first example. The example of the Shunammite woman and her needs. Now, we've met this woman before in our studies in the life of Elisha. Because remember, this is the woman, because you see a little review of it in the first couple of verses of this chapter. This is the woman, remember, when Elisha kept going by, and she and her husband said, "We need to build a room for the man of God." So they build a room on the upstairs part of their house. They turn their house into a bed and breakfast for Elisha the prophet. And remember, Elisha's servant had said, "Well, this woman doesn't have a son." And Elisha promised her that she would get a son. And then there's the example of the son dies. Remember, he said, "Oh, my head. And he dies. And Elisha first sends his servant, and servant, nothing happens. And then Elisha goes and lays down on him. And the young man is recovered from the dead. So all of this is background for this particular narrative. So Elisha apparently had a real love for this woman. She had been so generous to him, and Elisha warns her that a famine is coming. And he tells her, go to the land of the Philistines, where you can survive the famine. Famines are periodic, and remember Elisha's predecessor had to be fed by the ravens, by the brook Cherith, to be able to survive in an earlier famine. This famine here was a 7-year long famine, so it's quite a famine. Jenny and I were watching we like to watch documentaries on American history, and we were watching about the Dust Bowl days. And being from Kansas, we had a particular interest in the Dust Bowls in the other days. And you remember in our own Dust Bowl days, you know, they had plowed up most of the Great Plains because they had had many wet and good years. And then the dry years came, and it blew, and it blew, and it blew, and everything dried up out in the Great Plains. Well, that's a picture you get here. This land had dried up. There was a famine. And you might say, well, what's happened with the famine? Well, the famine was likely a divine judgment upon Israel. And Elisha is going to warn this woman about a famine so she personally can escape the judgment. She is a godly woman. She provided the little room for him as he traveled back and forth, and he wanted to take care of her. But the way the narrative unfolds, in leaving, she gave up title to her land. And now she needs to go back for an audience with the king to be able to get her land back. And here's where we see this remarkable providence, because she comes in to talk to the king. And the king happens to be talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. And you might say, okay, this is the same guy that became a leper and the Naaman thing. When is this, before and after? We don't know. We aren't given a timetable here. And I don't think we should always press the timetable as if, because the only time markers we have is now this happened, and now this happened, and now this happened. And, you know, you can't put a timetable just with the word now this happened, and now that happened. Could be before, could be after, we don't know. That we have to leave that in that way with a certain unknown. But the king is most likely here Jehoram or Joram, depending on which particular, Joram is simply the shortened version of Jehoram. Had become a devout believer at all, but what's strange in this passage is he seemed to have had a fascination with Elisha, because he's asking questions. And when the woman walks in, he's asking questions of Gehazi about Gehazi's master, Elisha. And it seems to be a curiosity that would prove to be quite providential. He showed, but as one commentator put it this way, he showed fascination, not faith. One of the old Puritan commentators put it this way. He was curious to hearken to the wonders of Elisha, but he was not careful to follow his doctrine. I like that. He was curious to hearken to the wonders of Elisha. In other words, you can basically paraphrase it. What kind of tricks has Elisha been up to lately? I like to hear these cool things that he does. But it didn't ever affect him. But just as he's talking to Gehazi about Elisha, hearing about the great deeds, focusing on Elisha raising the Shunammite son, because certainly if there was a great deed, that would be a great deed. Lo and behold, in walks the woman with her son to request restoration of her land. Not only does this allow Gehazi to verify that indeed this is Elisha, and indeed he says, this is the very son right here. Ask him. Ask her. Dead, now alive. But it gives the king the golden opportunity to restore the woman's lost land, which he does. This is a remarkable providence. Something that an unbeliever can only chalk up to sort of a Ripley's Believe It or Not strange providence. But we are to see this as showing the Lord, as we sang in our opening hymn, God moves in a mysterious ways his wonders to perform. And this is God's mysterious ways. You know, people always like to talk about coincidences. These aren't coincidences. These are divine providence that we see the Lord being gracious to this woman in a providential way. First, Elisha has warned her about the famine, so she flees. She comes back, no land, her house, land is all gone. Walks in at the very time this pagan king, well, he's not really totally pagan, but he's a very backslidden and confused king, because the northern kings at their very best, that's what they were. You know, they were the people that followed in the ways of Jeroboam, who made Israel to sin. That was the best. The worst were people like Ahab, married to Jezebel, the horrible Baal worshipping woman. So anywhere between those two options is where you're going to find these Israelite. This is the northern kingdom, remember. So and as old Bishop Hall said, she was more fascinated with the strange things Elisha was doing than believing the doctrine that Elisha was teaching. But the timing is impeccable. God is taking care of this woman. But the next narrative in this account is another providence, but of a different type. We don't know why Elisha is in Damascus, because we have no other record of him leaving the country of Israel. Maybe he was there to carry out the command that was given back in 1 Kings 19 for Elijah to anoint Hazael. Because you notice he meets Hazael here. We don't know that, but biblical scholars have speculated that that's likely something connected with it. But Elijah had been unable to fulfill that task because things had changed. Remember, Elijah went up in the flaming chariot, and he had anointed Elisha to take his place. Some suggested that Elijah had postponed that because Ahab seems to have temporarily repented, but we know it was only temporary because Jezebel seemed to still wield a lot of control. Well, there's still more about Jezebel if I get the chance to come back, and we'll talk about some of the things, more things. The really strange one about Jezebel, of course, is when she gets killed and she has to put her makeup on before she gets tossed out of the window. This goofiest story in all of the Bible, the woman who says, oh, before I get down, I gotta put my eye makeup on before I get tossed out of the window. But anyway, that's still farther along in the book of 2 Kings. But Elisha arrives, and he arrives at a time when Ben-Hadad, the Syrian king, was sick. Now, Ben-Hadad is a pagan king. He's a Syrian. But he probably had heard about Elisha from Naaman. Remember, Naaman was his right-hand man who Elisha had cured of leprosy. We looked at that a few weeks ago. That's a great narrative where Naaman comes down and he's first really ticked off because he thinks, well, maybe I thought he's going to come out and pray over me and do some fancy stuff. And does he just go wash in the Jordan River? And that's that crummy river. And I got all these better rivers back, much better rivers to wash in. But his servant says, well, he didn't ask you to really do that much. He probably would have heard then of his cure of leprosy. And we see then that Ben-Hadad, the king, thinking, okay, that guy Elisha, powerful miracle-working guy, like a typical pagan king, he thinks, well, I probably need his help. So he sends Hazael loaded with gifts. It says he sent 40 camels. Did you see what he says here? He told him to meet the man, loaded with gifts, 40 camels. Now, biblical scholars have speculated, how much was really in the 40 camels? Because some biblical scholars have pointed out we have records of this kind of thing that they would try to make it look impressive. And you had one little tiny box on a camel, and you sent a lot of camels. It's sort of like if you wanted to make somebody think they get a lot of Christmas presents, and you wrap up, you give them a bunch of silverware, and you put one spoon in one box, and you put another fork in another box, and the knife in another box. Oh, look at all the Christmas presents I give you, and it's really five sets of silverware, and you got it in, 20 boxes or something. Some have speculated that. Basically, we don't know. But we do know that he's thinking like a typical pagan king. If I'm going to get this guy Elisha to do my bidding, I got to wine and dine him. Yeah, 40 camels, even if there's only one box on it, it's still pretty impressive. Hazael comes out there with a train of 40 camels to say, the king, he wants you to come and heal him. Now look it, I got gifts, bearing gifts, 40 camels, a lot of presents. He was eager to get well and use any means available to get Elisha, the Israelite prophet, not even from his own country, to heal him. He sends Hazael as his envoy. He seems to have had great trust in this man, Hazael, to send him. You know, if you're going to try to get somebody to come heal you, you don't send somebody you think is going to double cross you, which is, as the narrative unfolds, that's clearly what's going to happen. Now, he comes up and he says, shall the king Ben-Hadad, the king wants to know if he's going to be healed. He says, your son Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, is a fascinating title, your son. What in the world does Ben-Hadad have to do with Elisha? But he's kind of buttering him up. He said, shall he recover? And then Elisha says this very strange thing. He says, go to him and say, you shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me he shall certainly die. Matter of fact, this is so strange that if you look in your footnote, in every modern translation, you'll say, some manuscripts say, you shall certainly not recover. Because some of the biblical scribes, when they were transcribing this, thought, must have been a mistake. He must have said, you won't make it. Of course, you're going to die. Because it seems like a strange contradiction. You know, yes, you're going to recover, but you're going to die. Well, I think if you try to do like a few scribes, occasionally scribes would do that. they would get a manuscript and they say, doesn't make sense to me. Let me edit it a little bit. Somebody must have transcribed it wrong in the past and I'll fix it. I don't think that's what's going on here. Because it misses the whole point of the passage. Elisha says to Hazael, yes, your master's going to recover from that, but he's going to die. And he looks at him. It says he looked at him intently and gazed at him until Hazael, he says embarrassed. Like you get the feeling he's just kind of squirming. Because, you know, it says that Elisha is looking straight at him. And he's squirming here. Now, I'm often reading about, as a historian, in the time of the Second Great Awakening, the great evangelist, and I say great not because I agree to a lot of his theology, I think his theology was abominable, but he was widely well-known evangelist, Charles Finney. They said that he had, and you can see it in some of the pictures, he had these piercing blue eyes, they said, that when he would preach, he would latch on to somebody and just about stare right through them. And then he would do his call people up to his anxious bench, and all those people that he had just like stared right through would feel guilty, and they would come. And I get the feeling it's something like that. Elisha has got these piercing eyes, and he stares right into Hazael, and he said to him, and then he weeps. And Hazael says, what are you crying about? The answer is that he gives here is, he says, I know what you're going to do. In other words, Elisha is saying, you, Hazael, God has given me insight into your wicked heart, and I know what you're going to do. This knowledge wasn't a comfort to Elisha. Matter of fact, anything but. He wept. It brought him great grief. Now, you might say, what was going on in Hazael's mind? We don't know. Some have suggested maybe he was plotting the overthrow of his master for some time. And this gaze was so disturbing that he was so embarrassed. It's possible he hadn't really plotted it out, but Elisha was simply seeing the evil that was in his heart. It may have been that Hazael thought that such events might have looked great on his resume, as the scholar Ralph Davis said. And he said, let me go ahead and do it then. We just don't know. But what Elisha is upset about is he understands that this was going to be, Hazael was going to be an instrument of judgment upon the people of Israel. Did you see the language? And some have said this is maybe sort of stylized, typical language. Maybe it is, but we need to take it seriously. He says, I know that you will kill the young men, you will set the fortresses on fire, you shall dash in pieces the little ones and rip open the pregnant women. This is serious judgment that Hazael the right-hand man of the Syrian king is going to do. He knew, Elisha knew that Hazael was going to be a serious instrument of judgment upon Israel, and the consequences were going to be severe. Hazael's answer, of course, is evasive. And he says, who is your servant who is but a dog that he should do such a thing? Basically, he says, me? I'm just a nobody. What do you expect? Me? Little old me? Don't expect me to do that. You know what's fascinating is when you look in the ancient Near Eastern records outside the Bible, the term that's used to describe Hazael, and then it says something like this, and then Hazael the nobody became king. That's literally what the ancient Near Eastern records say. Hazael the nobody became king. He understood he was a nobody. He was just a servant of the king. But he ended up concocting a plot. He goes back and he is asked by the king, shall I survive? Did you meet Elisha? And he says, he told me that you would certainly recover, which of course is a half-truth. And then the text says the next day he took the bedcloth, or some translations say a heavy cloth, dipped it in water, and went and smothered the king while he was sleeping. And what you see as the narratives will further unfold is he becomes then the king of Israel. Now, you have to remember, the Israelite kingdom was, I've often described it, this is kind of like banana republic politics. You know what a banana republic is like? The guy with the most machine guns gets to be El Presidente. And that's a little bit what the Northern Kingdom is like. You know, like a dozen dynasties or something like that in the Northern Kingdom. One right after the Southern Kingdom, one dynasty that went from pretty good to semi-bad. The Northern Kingdom went from bad to really bad, and it was like a revolving door. Well, Hazael is one of those revolving door kings. He murders Ben-Hadad up there in Syria. He's like the Northern Kingdom. He's one of those revolving door kings, and he becomes the king of Syria. Well, we see here God's sovereign providence directing the affairs of men, but this time it's in the political realm, a very different experience of God's providence. Elisha is very aware that God was going to use Hazael to bring judgment upon Israel, and he could weep over the judgment, but he could still recognize the hand of God in this. And this is part of the mystery of God's providence and God's working with evil in this world. Every Christian, and I know Jenny and I just had a discussion about this recently. How does God work out his providence in this world? You know, we talk about permissive decrees, which is a good theological way to describe what's happening. We talk about in providence, divine concurrence, that God's not the author and cause of evil, but he's actively involved in it, even without causing it. There's a mystery there, no doubt about it. But the one thing we can say here is God is working out his purposes. The purposes are, for the sake of the Shunammite woman, good purposes. In the midst of famine, in the midst of turmoil, she's there at the right time with her son. Gehazi is explaining to the king about what Elisha has done. And this looks like just incredible timing, but because it's God's timing. In the case of Hazael, he's there and is planning to do evil. Murder is certainly an evil act. Doing judgment, the judgment Hazael will bring upon the people of Israel. The individual acts are evil acts, but they are also divine judgment that God is going to use upon the northern kingdom of Israel, which was a pretty rotten kingdom. And being foreordained by God, being instruments in the hands of God, does not mean that sinners are relieved of their guilt. You know, never forget that in the book of Isaiah, Cyrus the pagan king is called, God says to Cyrus, you are my servant. You might say, wait a minute. How in the world can a pagan king be God's servant? Because God was going to use Cyrus in the restoration under Nehemiah and Ezra of the people of God. Someone can be a servant of God in the sense of carrying out God's will without even being a believer themselves. Now, we also see in Haziel some of the depths of human depravity and how the human heart can rationalize its behavior. One of the old 19th century commentators on this put it this way: we are often good because we have not been tried. Haziel was definitely tried. He had the motive. He had the opportunity. He could even probably rationalize it by saying, well, the prophet of God said the king would die. In other words, if the prophet of God says he's going to die, that gives me a blank check to do this act. Yet, he is not relieved of the guilt for murdering his master. Those wicked acts upon that he will carry out against the people of Israel are still God's perfect judgment on the people of Israel. God's providence is certain. It can be unpleasant at times. Other times, it can be a great relief. But even as he uses wicked men and holds them fully responsible, we see God working. And I think when we, as that old 19th century commentator said, it should drive us to look at our own hearts. No. The potential to be a Haziel is there in every one of us. It should drive us back to the grace of God, drive us back to the cross, where we can say, there but for the grace of God go I. Lord, help me to be a good instrument of your providence rather than to be a wicked instrument of your providence. God's providence is worked out here, both for in what we call would call a good way and in what we would call an evil way. But our Lord is still in control of this, of the whole chapter, of all the events that are happening. And we can trust, as we our opening hymn said, behind a frowning providence, he has a smiling face. We don't understand it completely. We never will. Matter of fact, I don't even think in glory. The Lord doesn't owe it to us to explain all of his ways. What we can say is, your ways are good, Lord. And we can trust you. Well, let's pray.